Good morning, y'all. That is a little bit of Stevie Wonder, Higher Ground live, different version than what you are normally used to hearing. This is, oh, they don't want to stop. All right, now Stevie and Sting, that's enough of that. All right, y'all, this is Brother A-Dub down here, 90.1 FM on your listening dial. Today is July 4th. 2015. I'm going to get into that in just a minute. But the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speaker. They do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. So whatever you hear down here, y'all charge it to A-Dub and to my growth and development that is ongoing. So you can reach me down here at 217-359-5483. That is 217-359-5483 if you would like to fly live. And I'm doing that little tribute to my good friend Mr. Reverend Zerniel Bogan, who will be moving on to a different city and state, y'all. So all that he has brought to WEFT, all that he has brought to this community, to our family, hats off to you. I salute you, my big brother. I appreciate everything that you have done, your example, your overcoming your obstacles and hurdles, and the things that you have gone on to achieve in your life. They are immeasurable. And we thank you. We love you. And we appreciate you giving us Fly Live 359-5483 down here at WEFT. And take the chance that you might be, and speak up, I should say, take a chance that you might be thought of as a fool. And as he would say, remain silent and you'll be thought of as a fool anyway. Indeed. That is my Reverend Bogan impersonation this morning. But we're going to miss you, man. But I do want to hear from you all. And I give you the area code 217 because you can call up a friend, a relative, loved one outside of the radio broadcasting area. And they can pick us up online and listen live at www.weft.org. WEFT.org. And they can click on listen live and they can also participate in this conversation this morning. Let's see. There's so much going on. Of course, we have the parade today, which is going to start at 11 o'clock. And we want to invite you to join me, Brother A-Dub and Sister Carol, a.k.a. Alderman Ammons and State Representative Carol Ammons, in the parade today starting at 11 a.m. We will be gathering on 1st and Kirby in the parking lot there or somewhere in that vicinity. And we will be lining up to participate in today's 4th of July celebration or parade. And we would like for you to walk with us. Join us, please. We don't have T-shirts, some little flyers and little things like that. Children will be out there. We'll make it a good time. And we'll raise some consciousness as we go through this day. I'm going to share with you all here in a few minutes, a piece written on July 5th, 1852 by none other than Frederick Douglass. So I want you to stay tuned for that. One announcement that I have, I'm going to have a guest on my show July 18th to discuss this further. But I do want to announce to you all now, and I'll share it again later in the program, that we will have a Pathway to Apprenticeship workshop. Pathway to Apprenticeship workshop on July 29th at Douglass Center in the library meeting room. So we want you all to participate in this. It's going to be on the 29th, July 29th at Douglass Center library meeting room from 1:30 till 4:30 p.m. Pathway to Apprenticeship workshop is designed to give the community, in particular the African-American community, a clear understanding of the process for individuals to become tradesmen. And we're talking about carpenters, plumbers, pipe fitters, electricians, those types of things, laborers, those types of trades that are career opportunities, well-paying opportunities, very educational career choices for those who are not going to be going off to college, or some may have gone to college and want to have a career in the trades. But we want to make sure we have that discussion, and we definitely want to get deeper into that discussion on the 18th of July when I come back to you. But I wanted to make this announcement. Please mark it down. We need to have as many folks there who are interested and ready to possibly have a career in the trades. This is not a job fair. Please write that down if you are taking note of this. This is not a job fair. This is an introduction to apprenticeship, the pathway to apprenticeship in the trades. There are some opportunities for individuals to possibly become tradesmen before the summer, or certainly over the next year or so. It is a process, but you have to get your bearings. You have to understand the process, or it'll come upon you again and you'll be SOL once again. We are working hard to make this to bring diversity to the trades. We're getting a lot of, good dialogue and movement from the trades with Matt Langendorf and Rusty Davenport and a lot of the other folks over in the trades. We've had great conversations with Chris Kleppel, who is a plumber and pipe fitter, who is also the president of the school board, because we know we need to have vocational curriculum in the schools, as well as many other of the tradesmen, Matt Kelly and some others, who are very supportive of what we're trying to do. And so we really need you to be aware of this and to make sure that you come prepared to take advantage of these potential opportunities. I will be talking to you more about that, but mark the calendar, July 29th, Pathway to Apprenticeship Program, which is going to be a lot of sponsors to this. State Representative Carol Ammons will be sponsoring it. The East Central Illinois Building Trades, National Council of African American Men, NAACP, North End Breakfast Club. We're all involved in this, and we want you to be involved in it as well. Whew. Farmers Market is going on. Absolutely. You need to get down there and get you some fresh produce after you get done listening to me, or before the parade or after the parade. I don't know how that's working. I really don't even know if the farmers market is open today, but I'm imagining that it is. So I'm putting it out there. What else do we have here? I don't know what else is going on, y'all. CU Citizens is not meeting today because of the holiday. And I don't know if I have anything else. If I missed anything, please charge it to my heart, to my head and not my heart, or however they say that. I'm getting a little beside myself this morning. One of the reasons why I'm a little, I guess, disturbed is that I'm anxious about reading this piece from Frederick Douglass. But I wanted to take a moment, 1 minute, to honor our good friend who is gone, Sam Britton. Rest well, my friend Sergeant Rock. You will be missed in the community, of course, at WBCP. And seeing you walking from WBCP to your home in Urbana, and all of the good times that you shared with us on the radio and all the support that you gave us when we were trying to get things done at WBCP. Condolences to the family, and we look forward to trying to move on without that voice down at WBCP. Shouts out to my good friend Joe Stovall, Mr. Purtle down at WBCP, Nora, as well as Bundy and all those, Mark, who are working down at WBCP. All right, y'all, I'm going to read as much as I can of an infamous letter or speech that was delivered by none other than Frederick Douglass, who lived from 1818 to 1895. This is a piece that he delivered in Rochester, New York, July 5th, 1852. So Frederick Douglass, a leading abolitionist and celebrated human rights leader, was born a slave in Maryland in 1818. As a child, Douglass secretly learned to read and write. It was against the law for a slave to do so. After escaping to freedom in 1838, he devoted himself to the abolitionist cause. A brilliant speaker, Douglass drew on his own personal struggles to drive home his anti-slavery message. In 1845, Douglass published his autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, which has endured as a classic in American literature. He also founded his own newspaper, the North Star, and served as an advisor to President Lincoln during the Civil War. In this speech, delivered at the invitation of the Rochester's Ladies Anti-Slavery Society, Douglass powerfully illustrates the hypocrisy of asking a slave to celebrate the 4th of July. "What does the 4th of July mean to a slave?" asks Douglass. "A day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude have been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as an hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you, this day, rejoice are not enjoined in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems is inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions. whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity which is outraged, in the name of liberty which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce, with all the emphasis I can command, everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, and yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not at heart a slaveholder, shall not confess to be right and just. So my time is running quickly here because I have to introduce my guest who's going to call in at 8:30. So I'm going to skip down to the last few paragraphs here and urge you all to look up Frederick Douglass, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, and read it yourselves. So go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. Fellow citizens, the murderous traffic, the slave trade, is today in active operation in this boasted republic. In the solitude of my spirit, I see clouds of dust raised on the highways of the South. I see the bleeding footsteps. I hear the doleful wail of fettered humanity on the way to the slave markets where the victims are to be sold like horses, sheep, and swine, knocked off to the highest bidder. There I see the tenderest ties ruthlessly broken to gratify the lust, caprice, and rapacity of the buyers and sellers of men. My soul sickens at the sight. Fellow citizens, the existence of slavery in this country brands your republicanism as a sham, your humanity as a base pretense, and your Christianity as a lie. It destroys your moral power abroad. It corrupts your politicians at home. It saps the foundation of religion. It makes your name a hissing and a byword to a mocking earth. It is the antagonistic force in your government, the only thing that seriously disturbs and endangers your union. It fetters your progress. It is the enemy of improvement, the deadly foe of education. It fosters pride. It breeds insolence. It promotes vice. It shelters crime. It is a curse to the earth that supports it. And yet you cling to it as if it were the sheet anchor of all your hopes. Oh, be warned, be warned. A horrible reptile is coiled up in your nation's bosom. The venomous creature is nursing at the tender breast of your youthful republic. For the love of God, tear away and fling from you the hideous monster and let the weight of 20 million crash and destroy it forever. Certainly, it's clear that we're not in chattel slavery at this particular point, or some might argue that the penitentiary system is indeed the new concrete plantations because the numbers are identical or worse in the penal institution than they were in chattel slavery, as far as those who are incarcerated eating just about the same type of food that they ate as slaves and doing very similar work that they did. It's just not in a cotton field, but certainly they are working for 3 cents an hour and doing various sharecropping that's taking place. And I do believe that I speak now from the standpoint of entering into conversations with other people, especially white America, about the social conditions and concerns that we have as African Americans. The context is what we just heard from Frederick Douglass. But all too often I hear, let's not go back that far. Let's just pick up where we are. We can't just pick up where we are because we wouldn't be where we are if we didn't have the context of the past. So you can't run from your past misdeeds. You have to own up to them, atone for them, and then we can move forward on solid ground. But we can't just ignore the hideous atrocities and ignore the ones that currently take place on a daily basis. The atrocities, the violence perpetrated upon African Americans even today. Unemployment, the actual violence and killing and death, miseducation. As we talked about earlier, the importance of why we have to have this pathway to apprenticeship, because we were systematically locked out of gainful employment intentionally. So these things are the backdrop. They are the context for the conversations that we have as we move forward. As we move forward. So what to a slave is the 4th of July is a relevant question for us as African Americans, even today, as we try to move forward, as we embrace independence. We had Juneteenth, which was more of an African American celebration of liberation after the Emancipation Proclamation finally reached the people in Galveston, Texas, and learned of the independence of the Emancipation Proclamation. So I'm hoping that this will serve as an appropriate context and backdrop for the conversation that we're about to have with Miss Jane Landers, who is the my special guest this morning. She will be calling in at about 8:30. Hope you all will tune in and stay closely glued to your radio and call in and maybe ask questions or make comments. So Jane Landers is an historian of colonial Latin America. She's the Gertrude Conway Vanderbilt Professor of History. Gertrude Conway Vanderbilt Professor of History. Dr. Jane Landers is an historian of colonial Latin America and the Atlantic world, specializing in the history of Africans and their descendants in those worlds. She is the author of Atlantic Creoles in the Age of Revolutions in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 2010, which was published in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2010. Getting a little ahead of myself. Which was awarded the Rembert Patrick Book Award and honorary mention for the Conference on Latin Americans History 2011 Bolton Johnson Prize for the Best English Language Book on Any Aspect of Latin American History. Her first monograph, Black Society in Spanish Florida, Urbana, 1999, 2001, 2002, 2005, was awarded the Francis B. Simpkins Prize for Distinguished First Book in Southern History and was a Choice Outstanding Academic Title. Landers co-authored the college textbook, The Atlantic World, A History, 1400 to 1888, and edited Colonial Plantations and Economy in Florida. And, Against the Odds, Free Blacks in the Slave Societies of the Americas. She also co-edited Slaves, Subjects, and Subversives, Blacks in Colonial Latin America, The African American Heritage of Florida, which won the Rembert Patrick Book Award and a commendation for the American Society for State and Local History. Lander's 2015 Nathan I. Huggins Lectures, Lander's 2015 Nathan I. Huggins Lectures, A View from the Other Side, The St. Dominic Revolution Through Spanish Sources, delivered at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University, will be her next publication. You can link to her lectures when you look her up, you Google her. There are links to her lectures. There's also a TED talk that she did where you could listen to Ms. Lander's. And so obviously there's plenty of stuff that she has written where you can read. She was awarded fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation and the American Council for Learned Societies for her current project, African Kingdoms, Black Republics, and Free Black Towns Across the Iberian Atlantic. Sundiata, this might be interesting to you. I know you have the first black town piece that you wrote about, so maybe this may be an interesting conversation. So you guys, if you're listening out there, again, the phone number is going to be 217-359-5483 for Ms. Lander's. When she calls in, you'll be able to ask her questions or challenge something that she brought forth or whatever. But Lou and Sundiata and Ken and all y'all out there, you historians out there, please tune in and offer your comments to this conversation. So Jane Lander's will be calling here shortly. And if she'd like to expound on some things, then certainly she'll have the right to do that or the time to do that. Oh, boy. She's taught quite a few courses, too. Africans in the Americas, Comparative Slavery, Destruction of the Indies, Pirates of the Caribbean. So she has an extensive background. She's done a lot of work. It's interesting because as we were talking about the context and conversations with white America, as a white female, it's interesting to see the perspectives that she's going to offer and what information she has uncovered. And as we talk about a revisionist history, one of the things that I'm going to raise with her, what does that do to the American psyche and to white America to take history and to distort it or to omit the contributions to civilization of African people? What does that do to the psychology? As we watched a clip of the pastor Moss, who talked about his son telling him one day that, you know, Dad, I know that these things are not true, what they say about all young black males, but all I see on the TV and all I hear on the radio and see on the news is that I'm the one that's the problem. I am this thing, this monster or whatever that they try to paint me to be. So the images are of me, of people who look like me, are not very positive images. So when you take that portrayal as well as the omission of our contributions to civilization all over the world, then it perpetuates a dehumanization of African people born in America or not born in America, but it depicts us as savage, as animalistic, and things of that nature. So I'm hoping that we will have a real conversation this morning on this 4th of July with Dr. Lander's and those of you who will hopefully call in and join the conversation. So she'll be calling in here shortly, and then we will go from there. All right. I'm trying to work this thing, y'all. So why don't I do my underwriting? This hour of programming is brought to you by Kevin Elliott Counseling, with a diverse group of 30 licensed therapists providing individual, group, family, and marital therapy. Kevin Elliott Counseling is located at 309 West Clark Street near downtown Champaign. For more information, call 217-398-9066. Or see Kevin Elliott, ELLIOTT, counseling.com. That's 217-398-9066. or see Kevin Elliott, ELLIOTT, counseling.com. Thank you very much for your underwriting support. We do appreciate that. All of our underwriters here down at WEFT 90.1. Boy, I love it when things go smooth. Good morning, Dr. Landers.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I am so wonderful, so great, and I'm excited to have you here. But, I mean, I just finished all of my preliminary stuff to the T, and the phone rang like clockwork. So I'm
well, you send that... good instructions.
Right. Good, good, good. So you are live on the air on okay. WEFT 90.1 FM. This is a community radio station, alternative radio station, and we try to bring guests like yourself to bring us good information to share with the listeners out there. And so I have read your bio and shared a bunch of your accomplishments, things that you have read, courses that you have taught, your interest in Africans' contributions to civilization prior to slavery and all those types of things. But I wanted to give you a few minutes to maybe share with the listeners what you like them to know about yourself.
Okay, well, about myself, wow.
Or
okay.
your work.
Okay, well, I guess one of the things about that may be of some connection here is that I grew up in the Caribbean, and I came to the United States when I was about 13, and so I had to make adjustments in culture and language and all sorts of things that I think made me think about culture and being moved from one place to another and having to adjust and finding your place. I think that shaped probably the kind of work I ended up doing as an historian, although I didn't know, of course, I was going to become one. Mm-hmm. And eventually I went into college thinking about doing something about Latin America. I did social work for about 5 years in Miami in the Liberty City projects while I finished my degrees. And then I ended up accidentally falling into some documents that were about runaway slaves from the American Revolution who were headed down to Florida. And I wondered, what was it all about? And I started backtracking in time until I got to some of the very earliest history of Africans in the Caribbean and in Latin America in general. And it starts, you know, it backs us up in time for African history quite a bit from what we usually get in the American history narrative, mm-hmm. which starts about 1619 with 20 bedraggled slaves getting off a boat in Jamestown. And we find instead, if we look from the other side, that this history is much longer, and it includes horrible slavery, but it also includes centuries of free and active engagement in all the geopolitics of the day.
Mm-hmm. So you said you were born in the Caribbean.
Well, I'm actually an American citizen, but I grew up in the Caribbean, in the Dominican Republic, which okay. Today is really having its own racial problems. I don't know if it's relevant, but it's the case that they are starting to evict Haitians from the Dominican Republic who have been born there, really of Haitian descent, not really Haitians.
But it sort of explains your interest in Latin America, you know.
Yeah, I think it does.
I didn't exactly
and
get
race.
That. Okay, all right. So, you know, I know there's a ton that we could talk about, but in particular, my wife, Carol, she had read some information that I don't know how she came across this information, but she said, hey, you should reach out to this doctor, to this lady, Dr. Landers. And
Jane's fine. Thank you, though.
Okay, Jane. So she said you should reach out to her and invite her on the show. So I appreciate you being so accessible. One of the things that I try to convey to people through the radio program is that we've had Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and we have professors from here, and historians and civil rights figures and stuff as guests. Just reach out to people. You don't know if they say no, they say no. I tried to get Dr. James Cone. He said, I can't do it. But, you know, you try, right?
Yeah, you should, yeah.
So, but
well,
I appreciate
your wife for me, too.
I certainly will. She's listening. So listen, one of the things that's most intriguing to me at this particular point is your understanding and the history leading up to the creation, if you will, of South Carolina. Because, of course, that's the big issue here. That's what everybody's wondering about. And my guest 2 weeks ago was Dr. Lou Turner, and he gave us an extensive understanding of Denmark VC and a little bit before VC and what that meant to the Civil War and to some of those particular things. So I thought it would, you know, it would be good if we even went back a little bit further from a historical standpoint, and if you would give us some framework or ground, some groundwork on what, how was South Carolina created? Who were the people who actually were the core group of South Carolina?
Okay. Well, I think it'll explain a lot about the racial situation that's contemporary, too, because originally it was Spain that claimed what is today the United States. They touched base in Florida in 1513, so that's well over a century past what the American history narrative reads. And there were free Africans on that expedition, and throughout all the Spanish Southeast, Africans were explorers and sailors and sometimes enslaved as well on those expeditions. But Spain was small, it didn't have a big population, and only managed to make a few small settlements. The oldest they made was St. Augustine, Florida, the oldest continuous settlement anyway. Then they made one up at Santa Elena, which is on modern-day Paris Island in South Carolina. But the Indians eventually destroyed that settlement, and the Spaniards withdrew down to Florida again. So that left that southeastern Atlantic coastline to the indigenous people that originally were there. And eventually, the English start settling some of the Caribbean, and they made sugar plantations in Barbados and then in Jamaica. And from Barbados, that's a small island, they had filled it with sugar plantations, which, if you all will recall, sugar is made with slaves. There's an old saying in Cuba, actually, sugar is made with blood, because it's such a horrible way to have to live in that sugar field from dusk to dawn and back again. And so Barbados quickly fills its island, and it's Barbadian planters that come to South Carolina in 1670 to establish the same kind of brutal sugar they hoped, but it didn't work out, of course, but plantation slavery on their model from the British Caribbean islands, which was a pretty horrible model.
Hmm. So those are the, you're saying that these are the people who came to make up the state of South Carolina. They were sort of the founders. Is that what, was that what I'm getting?
That's right. It was actually property that was claimed by the, I mean, Spain claimed it, but couldn't hold it. And so the British pretty well squat in it. And the British crown gave property grants of land to these wealthy investors, really, from Barbados. And they came in 1670 to establish what later became Charlestown. And from there on out, because Spain said they would not recognize it, there's a warfare along the whole Atlantic coast between Spain and Great Britain. And they're mercenary and allied armies of Indians and Africans.
Okay. You know, I kind of got ahead of myself because I had a whole list of questions that I wanted to give you, because one of the things that that I was hoping to get across this morning that was of particular interest to me as well was you had talked about in some of your previous work that there's a time period when people were not enslaved based upon skin color.
That's right.
Right. You kind of covered the fact that there were African people who were explorers. You said they were mariners. They were cowboys. There was a whole bunch of things that that took place we were doing as a people before being enslaved. Some of us being enslaved. Mm-hmm. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about. Let's just back up a little bit and talk about what was going on and what was the reasoning behind slavery before it was about skin color? How did that work?
That's a great question, and it's the key question, really, because slavery is a global system. It's existed as long as we can find, practically. But there are different types of slavery, different philosophies of slavery, different legal systems of slavery, and so on. And the one that Spain and Portugal and the Mediterranean world was familiar with, even before the Americas were discovered by Christopher Columbus, was an old system of the Roman Empire. And Rome had occupied Spain and Portugal, and they left behind their legal system. So Roman law considered that slavery was an accident of fate. You were not killed on the battlefield, or you were so poor you could sell yourself into slavery. Parents could sell their children into slavery if they thought they might survive better. And the state could condemn somebody to slavery, perpetual slavery, for some kind of a crime. So it's an accidental condition, and it's a legal condition, not a racial one. And the same way you could become a slave, that same Roman legal system also offered many ways out of slavery. You could buy your way out. A slave could earn money on his feast days or whatever, own property. They had the rights to property, and they could accumulate money to buy themselves free or members of their family. And also, owners could manumit or free their slaves legally. Mm-hmm. There was no prohibition against it. And the state could free people for military service or service to the government in some way. And so it's a fluid condition. It's not permanent, and it's not racial. So those are the huge, huge, huge differences. When the English finally get into coming to the Americas, or the Caribbean really first, they had no centuries-long experience with Roman law, and they use a whole different system. Anglo-Saxon law, or English law, is based on the principle of property and chattel, it's called. And so slaves were considered nothing more than another piece of property, like a cow or like a farm tool. And that's how they're listed on the records, too, with no last names usually. And they're just in the property list. Whereas in the Spanish and Portuguese and other Roman legal system documents, they're considered fully human beings with souls to be saved. So the Catholic Church gets in on that and tries to convert everybody. And it's a whole different conception. So always in communities, there were both free and enslaved people. And the enslaved could include, in the old world, include Spaniards, Gypsies, Jews, Muslims, Canary Islanders eventually. And when they bring it to this side of the water, then they also initially enslaved the indigenous people. And so it's a very multiracial slavery. Mm-hmm. And it only later in the plantation era becomes more like what the English had in mind.
So now that sort of leads me, it sort of puts me back into the flow that I was hoping that we would carry this conversation, because we talk about how slavery, which has been a part of the world for thousands of years, it's not a new concept, but how it's implemented or how it's structured changes place to place. And would you say, from your history and your research, that you found this form of North America's, or the English form, to be far the more brutal or the most destructive?
Yes, I do, if you compare it to what I'm finding all over the Spanish world. And I certainly do not want to appear as an apologist for any kind of slavery. You never wanted to be a slave.
Right.
But if I were given my druthers, it would be the Spanish system, and I would try to get to a city, not a plantation. And, in fact, that's why, from the beginning of the settlement of South Carolina, from the 1670s forward, enslaved people that are living among the English vote with their feet, if you will, and run southward. And it's the first real underground railroad goes to Florida instead. And to the Indian nations, we lose trails of the people that ran to the Indians, but we find them when they come into the Spanish world, because the Spanish wanted to convert them, receive them, hurt their enemies by, you know, accepting in their runaway slaves, et cetera.
So it's such a broad topic and so
yeah,
sensitive.
We're
trying
covering
to,
centuries here, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And so I'm just trying to paint a picture, because a lot of times we get into this conversation about slavery and what we're going to lead up to, and as far as current racial issues today. Mm-hmm. We talked about that there was a different approach to slavery by the English and what ended up being slavery in North America and
right.
maybe even in South America as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
But seeing African people as people, many times we talk about slavery and say slaves were brought from Africa.
Right.
No, African people with cultures, with lives, with families were made into slaves or turned into, worked as slaves, right? They were not this dehumanized slave and just captured in some sort of barbaric state and brought here. You know what I mean? It's just the way
right.
the picture is painted and the way the revisionist history is written gives a narrative that is not becoming, and certainly does not give the just due to the accomplishments of African people.
It certainly doesn't. And, you know, one of the things that you just mentioned is that they were not captured. It's true. Europeans had very little resistance to disease, and they died like flies on the African coast involved in that slave trade. So the slave trade is actually carried on by African middlemen, but encouraged and incited by the introduction of European guns, sometimes horses, as far south as the tsetse fly would allow horses to roam, and also by bringing in trade goods that people would want. And so it becomes part of a huge Atlantic world commercial system that it was not before the Europeans created the demand for slaves in plantation economies. There had always been slavery in Africa, but it might be domestic slavery. It might be conquest in war. Just as well, the Africans might kill their enemies. In Dahomey, for instance, the custom was to just decapitate your enemies after you won a battle, and it showed your victory.
Mm-hmm.
And when there became a market for slaves across the Atlantic, it was more efficient and profitable for the winning kings to sell the slaves away, who would never come back to fight them.
So now let's maybe reiterate where we went first, and which I should have did more like third, right? Because I think we're establishing, most people are aware when they look at the history of slavery, they are aware that we're talking about real people, real human beings,
right.
But there's still a struggle to give that level of humanity to a people who have been so dehumanized through literature, through imagery, through conversation and stuff like that. And so if just for a brief moment, what is unique about these people, again, who founded South Carolina?
Well, the people who came from Barbados already had that dehumanized idea of Africans, because they had already been abusing them in the sugar plantations that they owned in Barbados. So they came with a preconceived idea that it took tremendous force and brutality to keep people enslaved in a sugar plantation system, or in any kind of plantation system, really.
Mm-hmm.
But they had that idea when they came, and they had the legal backing of the Anglo-Saxon chattel law, and they wanted to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would try to squeeze labor out of the people they considered already subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that the Spaniards, not out of any, goodwill, but politically saw the advantage in you know, trying to ruin those planters by accepting runaways. And then they also did have a religious obligation. In Roman Catholicism, you are supposed to accept people who want to come to what they called the true faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out of their 800-year-long war against Islam in Spain and Portugal, that these religious conflicts overlap the system of slavery, and the church really trumped all. And so there is a whole legal system that's under Roman law. There's a whole ecclesiastical legal system as well, and that really trumps in the end. So you are supposed to welcome everybody into the faith, and you are supposed to see them as human. You are supposed to, even if you acknowledge slavery, you're supposed to keep families together. You're supposed to allow conjugal relations. You are not allowed to abuse women. You are not allowed to abuse anybody. And that's not to say it always functions the way it's supposed to, but those were the very, very strong, you know, restrictions against slavery in the Spanish Catholic world, both mm-hmm. legal and church law.
Mm-hmm.
And they operate pretty well for a long time.
But then when we start talking about, you said
plantations.
So when the plantation system comes in,
see
a much more brutal form of maintaining, trying to maintain.
If you went into Cuba in the 19th century and found sugar plantations, you'd find something that looked much more like English slavery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of things that we hear in the history books and that I remember personally is that all we hear is about cotton fields,
right.
cotton fields. But the sugar plantations, are you saying it's sort of the impetus that says, hey, this is when the sort of plantation system kicks off is through the sugar plantations.
Right. That was the first big moneymaker. It starts off the coast of Africa, it moves to the Mediterranean, and then it moves to the Caribbean. Later, sugar, but that's not until really the 19th century that cotton, later is cotton, about the 19th century. So before it was crops like sugar, and in South Carolina it was rice. That was the big money maker. They tried indigo. That didn't go well. They had forestry industries where the initial African laborers were often timbermen and log cutters, and they introduced cattle because you can roam around the forest and track cattle without too much investment other than the cattle and the slaves to track them. But
mm-hmm.
that means a pretty mobile kind of slavery. That's not everybody in a cotton row from the sun up to sundown, you know?
Mm-hmm. So,
and then you get to learn the geography. You get to meet indigenous people. You get to learn cultures, and you find a way to escape.
When you're talking about when they were timbermen and logmen and they were able to roam
and cattlemen
and things like that.
And hunters and traders and linguists. They were often the translators. They end up, if you think about it, on the West African coast, there are so many diverse languages that many people grow up multilingual. And that's a real asset when you're trying to make it in a new system, as I also discovered. And they become translators and linguists, often the middlemen between Europeans and the other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we have now we're coming up to South Carolina. You kind of mentioned that South Carolina had some rice. The rice was one of the big profit crops for them as far as slavery early on.
Mm-hmm.
And South Carolina, you said this sort of brutality. Was South Carolina one of the first places in the North America to have slavery? Or how does that work? Or to have slaves on those on the plantations like that?
Well, in the whole southern tier of the United States was claimed by Spain. So if you went from Florida, eventually out all the way to California, you would see Spanish law, Spanish missions, all kinds of Spanish things. To the north of Florida is South Carolina's the first of those in 1670. There were already Pilgrims and Puritans farther north, but they never developed a plantation economy. So Virginia eventually has a plantation me in tobacco. It's their big crop.
Mm-hmm.
And they require African slaves, too. But it is not as brutal a system to work in physically every day as sugar.
Mm-hmm.
South Carolina never really got sugar. It got rice. And that's brutal, too, in a different way, because you have to build huge systems of dikes to get water into the rice. Mm-hmm. And so digging those dikes, a friend of mine in Sapelo Island once explained, was almost like the equivalent of building a pyramid, if you think of how many dikes and water systems were built and repaired over those long years of slavery in the rice fields. It's a pretty amazing labor.
Hmm. So listen, you are listening to WEFT 90.1 FM when you're listening dial. This is Higher Ground with yours truly, Brother Aaron, a.k.a. Brother A-Dub, Alderman Ammons, whatever it is that you would like to call me. My special guest this morning is Dr. Jane Landers, Vanderbilt University, and we are discussing the history of African contributions to civilization, basically, especially in the Americas. And so, Dr. Landers, I'm just trying to do a little station identification here.
Sure.
Let folks know they can give you a call and ask you a question or even make
okay.
a comment. 217-359-5483 is how you all would get in. 217-359-5483. All right. So let's bring it on up to we're in South Carolina now. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a particularly violent or brutal place for African people who were slaves there?
Well, it really sort of depends on where you are. If you're in the city of Charleston and you're doing domestic labor, it's certainly preferable to, for instance, working in those rice fields I was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on your
where you
situation.
Are geographically.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the rice fields were where at in South Carolina?
Well, they're all, you would try to get near rivers and you want access to water because you have to build these dike systems in which you lift the gates, the floodgates, and let the water in. And it's quite an evolved practice. And there's a very, long debate and interesting discussion historically about whether or not it was Africans who introduced rice to South Carolina. Fall on the side of the people who say it was, and that they brought with it all of the knowledge of the very interesting and difficult way of growing rice, knowing when the water had to be in, how to plant the little shoots. It's quite complex. And so rice, ironically, ends up being the big money crop in South Carolina. It's African laborers and African technology, basically, that make it possible.
Mm-hmm. So in South Carolina, you have, like you said, we've talked about the particular barbaric and brutal way of the plantations were maintained, the sugar plantations mm-hmm. were maintained, and it's those people who come to as founders of South Carolina, and then we don't have sugar plantations.
You're breaking up a little bit.
Okay, I think you're breaking up a little bit here, too.
Oh, maybe I am. I'm sorry. Okay, now I can hear you.
All right, so we sort of established that the sort of barbaric and inhumane treatment and stuff comes from the sugar plantations, and those people from Barbados are the ones who come to help found South Carolina.
Right.
And so we're in South Carolina now. What is the, I'm trying to make sure I have my question clear here that I just wanted you to talk a little bit, I guess, about the any resistance, revolts,
okay.
rebellions and stuff prior
sure.
to Denmark Vesey.
Okay, it so seems, 1670, yeah. we get him on the ground from Barbados with these backward ideas about subhuman Africans. However, they're landing in an indigenous world, and they're also trying to, first of all, enslave Indians and abuse Indians who were already on the ground as well. So eventually we're going to see an alliance between the abused Indians and the abused Africans down the road, a little piece in the Yamasee War in 1715. One of the early crops, remember, that I mentioned, or products that I mentioned that was an economy was cattle, but also deer hide were another thing that they made money on in the original settlements before you get big fields planted and big dikes built and so on. So they abuse the Indians often for the deer hide trade. And eventually, the Indians of the coast where the English are and the African slaves on the coast where the English are come together in a huge war called the Yamasee War in 1715. And they fight and almost eradicate the English settlers who have to run for the boats, basically, in the Charleston Harbor and save their lives. And eventually troops come from North Carolina and Virginia to help the English planters, more English people from North Carolina and Virginia, help them fight the Yamasee Indians and the African slaves that joined them. And the ones who survive head south for Florida. And so I can track individual Africans who fought in those wars, who were freedom fighters from the early 1700s, who in the English records would never even appear by a name or anything else. And I find them, and they tell their big stories when they come into the Spanish and ask for religious sanctuary. And so one of the figures that I track, I'm writing a biography of him now, but I've written quite a bit about him, is a man who was of the Mandinga Nation in what is called sort of Senegambia, near the Gambia River in West Africa. He was somehow enslaved, I'm still trying to find that out, by the English and brought to Carolina in the early 1700s or late 1690s. And he joined in that war. He and others joined in that war and eventually come into the Spanish realm. And he becomes a baptized Catholic. He takes the name Francisco Menendez. He has his wife with him. He becomes the leader of all of the runaway slaves from South Carolina. And eventually there are enough of them that the Spanish governor grants them their own lands and sets them up in the first free black town of what is today the United States. And it was modeled after an Indian village system. So there's a Catholic priest that would try to teach everybody the catechism and so on, and baptize them. And Francisco Menendez becomes the acknowledged lord, the Spanish records say, the natural lord of this town. And the other people, the Spanish records say, are his subjects. And so he becomes a captain in the free black militia. He's the leader of a free black town. He is known as Captain Francisco Menendez. And he leads a number of guerrilla operations back north up against the South Carolina planters. And in some of those, they bring out slaves with them back to Florida. So it's sort of a Harriet Tubman in reverse over this geopolitics and the war between the English and the Spanish. The runaways clearly see the advantage to getting into the Spanish system.
Mm-hmm. And what was the name of the first free black town?
The first free black town is called in Spanish Gracia Real de Santa Teresa de Mose, and that means by the royal grace. I've created this town, it's in the honor of Saint Teresa, the Catholic saint, who is also the patroness of the military. And Mose, there's a debate about that. Some people think that was already an indigenous place. But there's also an African kingdom in West Africa by the name of Mossi, M-O-S-S-I, on the European maps. And I'm wondering if there's any connection. I haven't been able to pin that down.
Okay. All right. So we're talking about Francisco Menendez. Is there a name, an African name?
I wish so.
No.
I haven't found it yet if there was. You know, the English often try to give people an English name, and the historian of Virginia and South Carolina, Philip Morgan, has written a wonderful essay about how they're often names that are made to be almost comical, so they'll be the names of Roman figures or whatever, Cupid, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So they don't usually give a last name. They don't usually keep the African name, but once in a while you'll find them in the list.
But so you're saying that I've heard you say in some of your other talks and your other work that this is a continuum of rebellions and revolts and And so we're starting sort of in the 1690s, early 1700s with Francisco Menendez. Is there someone that you would point to after him?
Oh, you know, I have books full of them.
Okay.
But another one that's really a fascinating character from South Carolina, since that's where we're focusing
okay.
today,
all right.
is one of those very first runaways. You know, remember I said I sort of stumbled into these records when I was in graduate school of slaves running during the American Revolution. So mm-hmm. down the road, we're in 1770s, you know, and I find these lists.
Jane, hold on yes. just for a second. We've got a call. I think they may want to ask you something. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Aaron, it's Paul. And good morning, guest.
Good morning.
I just point one thing out before I mention what I was calling about, and that is I've had arguments with melatonin-deprived individuals who always point out that the African leaders on the coast of Africa participated in the slave trade, and there was slavery mm-hmm. before that. But it seems to me, and I think you did mention it, that you know, there were armed gunboats with, you know, 16-inch cannon rounds in the bay at these port cities. How voluntary is any kind of participation in that kind of circumstance?
It depends when you're talking and where you're talking, because all the European nations, of course, participated in the slave trade. The Portuguese start the whole damaging adventure, and they grab people and run back to Portugal with them, and the next time they come back, they're beaten off and killed in the river. So it just depends when and where you're talking. I think you're probably now up to the 18th century in English, late 18th century, early 19th century, and of course the English are the biggest slave traders, and that's where most of the millions of people who are enslaved come out of the English world, as you say, with a powerful navy by this time, well-armed and so on. But they never fought their way to the interior. They never conducted the trade in the interior. They couldn't. It's but it's on the coast.
But it's so important to any polity to have that. Anyway, what I wanted to ask about and mention, I follow Aaron, and I'm going to, in the second half hour of my show today, I'm going to put on a book chat with Gerald Horn talking about the his really incendiary book called The Counter-Revolution of 1776, which the Somerset case in England really shattered a lot of minds in the colonies to the effect that, you know, they freed property in the regard of the colonists.
Yeah, that was a transformative moment.
Yeah. So, and I know there's some people who criticize Horn, and I think it has to do with the diminishing agency of the African, people in the past. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's real. I think that I think a fuller picture has to look at the role of the states and the Spaniards and different factions, et cetera. But it shouldn't diminish, Denmark Bases and all the other people that led rebellions, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I totally
agree. I think part of that derives from just our Anglo-centric narrative of history. It's as if only the important things happen when the English do them. So.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the call, man.
Very good. All right. Very good.
So, I mean, that's a little bit of the... it was taking us a little bit further ahead, and we'll come back to something, sort of tie that in here also.
Okay.
So you were talking about 1770s, South Carolina. There's an individual who is a sort of looked to as a leader or something of one of the revolts or rebellions.
Right. Well, one of the other people that I have found documents on and written about in my book, Atlantic Creoles in the Age of Revolutions, is this man that in the English world was known as Big Prince Whitten. And in the Spanish world, he becomes a baptized Catholic. He is Juan Bautista Whitten. But I found him when I was still a graduate student. I came across these little paragraph entries that the Spaniards were making on everybody that was coming in to the colony and asking for refuge, asking for religious sanctuary. And it would be a paragraph about, well, I ran away with the Indians and I lived with them for a while and so on, and now I'm coming to you. Or the English took me away from my plantation and then I ran away. And they'd just be little brief things. But this one man that I read his paragraph also was so interesting, and I found a runaway slave ad for him that the Georgian owner was publishing at the same time, and it described him as over 6 feet tall, big and brawny, big Prince Witten, talkative. His wife was described as Judy, also a talkative wench, and he had two children that just caught me, and I've been tracking them 20 years now. One was Polly, who was gently pitted with the pox, and Glasgow, a smiling countenance. And this family had tried four times to run away from slavery. They had been through, as I came to find out, the horrors of the American Revolution in South Carolina, which was just about the bloodiest you could get, with terrible devastation on both sides, and slaves right in the middle of it, and smallpox epidemics. They went through horrors, and eventually Big Prince is moved with his family down towards Georgia by the English troops that had him, and they escape finally across the St. Mary's River, which was the international border south, and they get to Florida. And so then I track them for the next long years of their lives until 1821, when he goes to to Cuba and takes the free black community off to Cuba, because the United States government is going to take Florida and they're going to make it a chattel slave system just like the English had it.
Okay. And so this was, you said this is Juan Bautista, also known as Big Prince. Am I getting
right?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think you just gave me a new nickname for my son.
Okay, good. I used to joke it's Big Prince, Juan Bautista, formerly known as Big Prince.
All right. So we do have just a couple of examples of revolts, of rebellions that were led by African people who were resisting this enslavement, this chattel slavement, this barbaric form of plantation brutality.
Right.
I want to call it domestic terrorism. I mean,
might
you know.
As well.
So that's what's going on here, and this is in particular. You're talking about South Carolina when we talk about Big Prince and Juan Bautista, formerly known. Well, you know, however you said it. Anyway, but we were talking about this is South Carolina, right? You know, this is going on there.
There are many, many more runaways from South Carolina. Those are just two that I had quite a lot of documentation for that I write about. But many others also show up in all that Spanish documentation, and they'll say they're from Charlestown, or sometimes they'll say formerly owned by so-and-so. Sometimes the people themselves will tell their runaway stories. Sometimes they won't come into the Spanish world. They'll go into Maroon camps in the Savannah River area, or they'll go off to live among the Creeks and the Seminoles. So we don't get everybody's story, but the ones we get quite a few runaways from South Carolina. And the other thing that makes South Carolina a little bit different, I think, than some of the other, you know, later southern colonies like Alabama and Mississippi, where it is that cotton antebellum image you get from Roots or Gone with the Wind, Charleston is an extension of the Caribbean, if you think about it. And it's a seaport, and there's ships coming in and out all the time from everywhere in the Caribbean and from Europe. And there are sailors all the time. There's water routes out of there, and It's much more a fluid boundary. It's not so bounded as some of the interior, you know, later planter societies.
That's one of the things that Dr. Turner talked about, the importance of there was a particular act that was implemented in South Carolina because there were so many seamen coming in. And
they couldn't get off the boats. They weren't allowed.
Exactly, because they brought so much information and things
like
that.
You know, there's a wonderful dissertation that was never published, but we all use it, by a wonderful scholar, Julius Sherrod Scott III, actually. And he is the first person to really pay attention to how semen served as the, if you will, all the information of the world is spread through semen, especially to people who couldn't read or didn't have access to other kinds of news. These people were walking information. It was a very important way to start thinking about sailors, which was a pretty degraded operation. But here they are carrying all this important news about the revolt in Saint-Domingue, for instance, or what mm-hmm. became Haiti, is all circulated through those southeastern ports and mm-hmm. And through New Orleans. And people who had been part of that experience came and they spread the word. And so, but that, if you back it up in time, happens all along. People spread word orally, even if they can't read.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. So my other question, and it's sort
Aaron,
of connected.
Aaron, can I just say one thing, too?
Yes.
One thing that we didn't really talk too much about. We talked about rebels, and we talked about maroons and sailors and so on.
That's but what I was going to ask you about, maroons. Are maroons, in essence, is that a definition of a runaway slave?
Yes, I'm sorry. It is. Mm-hmm. It comes from the Spanish word cimarrón, which meant originally like a runaway animal of some kind, and they end up saying the same word, and it gets picked up in English as maroon and in French as marron.
Well, I ask because I graduated from the high school here. It's called Central High School, and the school is known as the Central Maroons. And
oh,
I don't,
you're kidding. Really? That's amazing.
Yeah.
In Illinois.
Well,
wow.
We found out that Illinois wasn't the most liberal spot, and, you know, and probably still isn't in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was interesting because
that
I didn't.
That is interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So please, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so those are all rebels of one sort. But another kind of image that may not be as familiar to listeners who have more of an American narrative is that because Spain and Portugal and these Roman Catholic nations were so small in population, they always had armies made of...
I'm sorry, you were breaking up there. Armies...
The whole of Latin America and militias as well.
Okay, Jane, are you there?
Also that the English chattel system... to dehumanize people couldn't stand the idea that these were armed troops led by their own officials, subsidized by the government of Spain and so on. And it gives a long tradition in the Spanish world that is another long source of records for me. So I find men and their sons and their grandsons all going into the military for the status they from prosecution grants also to keep out slavery.
So, Jane, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. You were breaking up that as soon as you started talking about the armies and the role that they were playing in this, you started to break up. So I'm going to ask you to go back there again. All
sure.
Right.
I just wanted to say something that a U.S. narrative would probably not recognize would be that Spain, being so shorthanded on population, always had free black militias from the middle of the 16th century, basically, all the way everywhere they were. So from the Philippines to California to Florida to, you know, Mexico, free black militias with armed black soldiers, with their own officers paid, who saw military duty with be on ships also going around the Caribbean and spreading information and finding out information. And so there's a long, long, very proud military tradition for Africans in the Iberian world, Spanish and Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can find their uniforms that they design themselves, and we can read about their battles as they go up for promotion, and it's a long military tradition that is another source of good history.
Well, it's pretty clear from what you're sharing that you had to go outside of American history and American records and things like that to
right.
find some of the other narratives, other stories,
mm-hmm.
and other places where history was captured and written down and things like that.
Right.
As we I want to ask you about this sort of revisionist history, but my wife wanted me to ask you a question early on. But one of the thoughts that she had in listening to your work after reading it was, what role, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but what role did the federal government play, if any, in establishing the Confederacy? Is that later?
That's way past my time, Aaron. You better ask an expert of that. I really do stop pretty much when the United States takes over the Lower South in the 1820s. I do follow the Black Seminole Wars on to about the 1860s, which leads up to the Civil War. But I'm always looking in the South and not in the Anglo South, basically, but the African Indian South.
Well, that's fine. I'll move on.
So
then.
I better pass on that one and let someone who really knows that answer.
Well, I appreciate that. So what impact... This is what I really want to get at, too, is what impact does a revisionist history, which minimizes or outright excludes the contributions of African people to civilization, have on the psychology of the average white American?
Well, you know, that's got a lot of stuff in it.
Yes, it does.
First of all, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't say, and I don't know what the average white American might say, so mm-hmm. I think it would depend on levels of education, where you were raised, that kind of thing. As we've seen, ideas that we think are so outdated and so barbaric themselves still live on in certain pockets of the United States, and I can't even believe that it is still there, but it is, as we sadly saw recently in Charleston. And, you know, there's been a very long, long, long narrative about that the Civil War wasn't about, you know, slavery. But how can you deny that? It's just too obvious. And so I think, you know, the type of people, and I don't consider them average, but the type of people that cling to those ideas will never believe what I'm talking about today and don't want to see it. No matter how much evidence I could compile. So
let me be more specific then, and I just really want you to answer it from the perspective of, as someone who was very interested in this information, having to go and find it and stumble upon it the way that you did. And what it has done, what has it done for you? So if that's your backdrop, like, what did this information do for you? How did it affect your thought process? Because I'm really trying to figure out, in particular, how does a revisionist type of history and an exclusion of the contributions of African people, how does that contribute to the violence perpetrated against blacks by the police? How does it contribute to these white supremacist groups? How does that stuff fit into their ideology, the lack of contributions and the revisionist
history? Yeah, I think it definitely has a role, and I think that's why I've dedicated myself to my whole career of working on this history, and I try not to just write for, you know, the few people that will read my footnoted works. I've worked with K through 12 student groups for my whole career. I've written a fourth grade textbook in Florida to revise that history totally. That was one of those adopted for the state. I've worked on public history museums. I go to reenactments of the Battle of Fort Moseley. I do everything I can, documentaries, museums, things that people might see that might change their ideas, even if they don't read my scholarly works. I want it to be public knowledge. I want people to see these African people in uniforms, see these families that risked everything to get free. I want them to know about these places that they never heard about. And so the way to do that is through things like, for instance, Skip Gates' wonderful documentary about Africans in the Americas. He's done quite a lot of that, and I did some work with Skip, and he's a master of making it more public on documentary shows. But there are other people that are working to make it a more visible place of history. It has to be, or else, you know, these myths of the Confederacy go on, and it just has to be supplanted and overwritten by what is the more accurate picture of centuries of both freedom and enslavement, but active participation by people of African descent in the history that made up this country. It isn't something, you know, to be glorified in the Confederacy. It's a long-term process of working through racial problems, and Africans helped build this place and are very critical to all of it, as they were throughout the Caribbean, as they were in Africa themselves. But so I think education is what it's going to have to take, a lot of it, and that's educating everybody from school children on up through police forces. So.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I try to get across to the listeners as well, especially as I talk to black folks, that you have Africans who were born in Africa, Africans who were born in South America, Africans who were born in North America.
Right.
As a good friend of mine, he says that, you know, I'm not African American. I'm an Abia. He says I'm an African born in America.
Okay.
Because he's trying to maintain, and I think it's consistent with what you're sharing now, is that you as a human being or from a cultural group have the right to maintain your cultural identity.
Yeah.
And even when you talked about Francisco Menendez, you're still talking about someone who has been renamed, a given a Spanish name, and
right.
we don't have documentation of what his African name was. You know, so it's things like that, that even on a today, on a day like today, the 4th of July, as we try to embrace the heritage, or I don't know if I want to say heritage, the fact that you are living in North America, and that there's a flag and there's a history, that there's a group of people who want to celebrate the independence or the conquering of this land. Right. And
right.
we understand that. But as I read Frederick Douglass's What to a Slave is the 4th of July,
mm-hmm.
prior
it's powerful,
to.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's extremely powerful. And I think that it's a disservice to North America to have a conversation on a day like the 4th of July without having a conversation that is inclusive of the entire history from the perspective of those who were in the bowels of those slave ships and who were in those sugar plantations and rice plantations and cotton plantations. Because I just think it is a you're ignoring, or this revisionist history is coming back to haunt us again, because now you don't have the participation of everyone who's involved in this land. You know,
let me I certainly agree with everything you just said. There are things that people don't celebrate because they don't know about it very much, is that Spain helped the United States win its independence from Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who were most of the troops on the Southern Gulf campaigns in Mississippi, up the Mississippi River, in Alabama, and the Caribbean? They were free black troops from Havana primarily, but some from Mexico as well. And they won medals for fighting in our American Revolution to help free us from the British. And so unless you read through the Spanish stuff or some of the newer works, you mm-hmm. wouldn't even know that. But these are free black militiamen who fought in our American Revolution in uniform, win medals, have a long military tradition, and we don't see anything about them usually in these sort of more, you know, average mm-hmm. kind of celebrations.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm working on right now, I'm working very extensively with the trade unions here in
mm-hmm.
Champaign-Urbana, and as you listed, seamen, explorers, mariners, timbermen, log cutters, cattlemen, hunters, tradesmen, linguists, translators.
Right.
I'm trying to convey two things. One, I'm trying to convey the same thing to two different groups. One is that we don't buy the notion that we're just not smart enough to be in these trades, because
oh,
we
gosh.
Have always been in these trades. We've always known how to do them. Even when you weren't taking particular math courses, you figured a way, you found out and figured out how to do a thing to make it work, right?
Well, in fact, all of the skilled craftsmen in the places I study in Latin America, the silversmiths, the tailors, the shoemakers, the carpenters, the masons, African-Americans,
mm-hmm.
or Africans born in the Americas.
Absolutely.
Let me just say one quick thing about Africa, too, Aaron, if I may.
Please.
Do we have a second?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. You know, also, because the history has been erased for so long, we start to use the term Africa, which is really a 19th century, you know, European idea, mm-hmm. Of some huge continent of people of a different color. And in the English records, maybe that's how you have to read it. But if you read the Spanish records, they're very precise on where somebody came from. Sometimes it even gives their birthplace. It tells you what ethnic group they belong to so that you can know the language that they spoke, so that you can know about their guilds and their crafts and their food ways and everything else. So one of the sources that I'm trying to save and make publicly available to people is the Catholic Church records that start in the United States from the 16th century for Africans and Indians. And they're online at Vanderbilt's library website. Of course, you have to be able to read some of it, but I'm saving it because they're dying as we are speaking right here. Things are rotting everywhere that tell you, was your ancestor a Mandinga man from the Gambia like Francisco Menendez, or was it somebody from Angola who had become a Catholic centuries before when the Catholic Church goes to Angola? You get specific African ethnicities through this different kind of source as well as a better history.
Hmm. So one of the things that I wanted to do, and you're sort of helping me get here, as we wrap up, I wanted you to talk a little bit about your work and what you thought it meant to the changes that we need to see. I'm trying to pull it up here exactly to address some of the racial issues that we face today. But before we even get to that, because we've got time, we got a few minutes here. I wanted to say to people before I forgot that there's some pretty interesting information that you can garner from a couple of places. And so you mentioned, say his name, Julian Sherrod Scott III?
Yes, it's a wonderful dissertation called The Common Wind, A Common Wind.
Common Wind.
Uh-huh.
And that's a dissertation.
It's
and
a then dissertation. You'd have to track a little bit, but most of us use it and cite it. He's a wonderful scholar.
Okay.
Peter Wood, who was my mentor, although I never got to study with him, but a wonderful friend of many years and encouraged my early work, wrote the best early book on the African heritage of South Carolina, and it was called Black Majority.
Black Majority. And who was the writer again?
Peter Wood.
Peter Wood.
He's the most, he changed everything I ever did in my career by reading that book. And that was the other point we really didn't talk about, that in the early settlement of South Carolina, whites are in the minority. Mm-hmm. It's an Indian and an African place.
Mm-hmm. So
it was a black majority. And that was one of the reasons they were so horrible to Africans as well. They were afraid.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I wanted to get to
terror,
that.
Terror, as you said, to try to control.
So I wanted to get to that before we got out here. I just wanted to reiterate to people first that you can find The Common Wind is another one piece that you can look to. Black Majority by Peter Wood. And you can also look for some of the Spanish records or within the Catholic Church records at Vanderbilt Library. And that's online, right?
That's right. And then, of course, my own books, I heavily connect to South Carolina because of this runaway corridor.
Okay. And so give us some titles there.
Okay. It's Black Society in Spanish Florida was my dissertation book. Mm-hmm. And another one is Atlantic Creoles in the Age of Revolution. That has the story of Big Prince Whitten in it.
Okay.
And his family. And I'm tracking all of them to Cuba now, too, because they leave the country rather than stay under the American government that will try to re-enslave them or put them in that chattel category again.
Okay. And then I also wanted to share with people, as you talked about the sugar plantation, it took me several years before I had an opportunity. Well, like you said, we watch Roots and some of those other different films and Amistad and stuff. It took me a minute to be introduced to Sankofa, the film Sankofa.
So Haley Garima I've worked with also. He's doing a film now on Maroons.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Uh-huh. So he came down to Mose, as they call it now, to interview me there and see some of the battle reenactments and so on. There's a nice little museum there that he filmed, and the community has taken it up. And so that's how you change it. That's how you change people's perceptions. You show the school kids, you know, the military heritage. You show them where they owned property. You show them what kind of occupations they had in this earlier period. You show them that there was a school in Spanish St. Augustine where white and black boys, only boys, unfortunately, went to school together learning the same curriculum. My man, Francisco Menendez, writes letters to the King of Spain expecting some reward for his bravery in the battlefield and so on. So the idea of literate, property-owning, family people, heads of household and community is something we have to make more visible.
Okay. Well, so as we sort of channel our way to the end of this conversation, it certainly goes fast. What do you think about all that you have learned through your research and stuff? Just sort of, I guess, synthesize this for the listeners. South Carolina, Dylann Roof, 9 people killed in a church. How does this connect to your work? How do you see what you've worked on either having some influence on that or contributing to that? And we've got a caller. Let's take the caller and see what they have. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the professor a question. It's my understanding that Haiti volunteered 15,000 troops to Lincoln to fight against slavery. Can you confirm that? Thank you.
I don't really work on that time period, so you'd probably want an expert to ask that question. But there were also free black militiamen from Saint-Domingue in our American Revolution in Savannah. So in my time period, yes, there were African-descended people coming from Saint-Domingue to help us win our freedom, in addition to the black Cubans that came.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, caller, for the question. I appreciate that. I do want to I'm really learning a lot from having the professors and historians and stuff who come on to share the research. One of the things, Jane, that I deal with as I deal with my family and friends who I grew up with in the African American community here is that in a university town, sometimes there's this tension between town and gown.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've been working on and what I've been trying to do is to bring in these very accessible, regular brothers and sisters, you know what I mean, who just happen to have PhDs to respect the time, sacrifice, energy that is put into research. Research is not just Googling something, right? You know,
right.
And reading a paragraph that's on it and you think you have some knowledge of it. It certainly is much more, far more in depth than that. And I really appreciate all that you have done and what you've shared with us this morning.
More to do still. There's so much more to discover. And I hope that some of the young listeners may want to take up the job of history and, you know, keep up the good work, because it's not a profitable profession, but I think it's an important one. And
history matters,
so
right?
I hope I can encourage some young scholars that are out there to come on in and help me.
Well, one of our friends always says history matters, right?
Yeah, it does.
So tell me, what do you think?
Aaron, can I just tell you a funny anecdote?
Oh, please, go right ahead.
It's a horrible anecdote, actually, but it tells what you're talking about the importance of changing longstanding perceptions. When I started as a grad student, I was giving a talk about one of the leaders of the Haitian Revolution, Georges Biassou, who comes into Spanish Florida because he decides to fight on the side of Spain. And he has a house there and so on. And I was talking about it, and somebody wrote in to the local newspaper saying that I was glorifying black rebellion and black bloody leaders, and that I was as bad as Muammar Gaddafi.
Wow.
And it was such a ridiculous image that about 8 people sent me these clippings from the newspaper. Well, that was some 20-something years ago. Now, because of the efforts that not just I, but other people have been making, his house is marked in St. Augustine. He's part of the regular Black Heritage Tour, if you will. Skip and I talked about him in the documentary. I write about him in my books. And so the perception of me as a terrorist, encouraging terrorism, came from some old person who was part of the same gang probably that threw acid in the pool where Martin Luther King stayed in St. Augustine during the worst of the 60s.
Wow.
And it has changed. And my hope is that with more education, with more publicity about this different kind of a past, that that old antebellum idea that you have talked about of subhuman people not smart enough to know anything will be erased, and instead we'll see that the ignorance lies on the other side among the people who rewrite the history and cling to some desperate past that they really were even unaware of.
So I have a good friend of mine who just walked in. This is how we do it down here at Community Radio, a fellow Wefty. And I'm sure if I don't know if he was listening or not, but I have, this is Dr. Jane Landers. She studies lots of different stuff. But Dave here is a labor movement, a labor historian.
Okay.
All right. So
there are a lot of crossovers in those two fields of history.
Yes, there is. But I wanted you to take a minute here and talk about some of that crossover. And then we're going to wrap it up with you telling us what you think, what you have learned over the years. How has it contributed to this environment that we're seeing in South Carolina? You know what? In fact, I need you guys to as Dave gets situated, I want to play something. I hope you'll be able to hear it,
okay.
Jane. And it is a piece that was written, a good friend of mine, Ray Morales, put together something called, it's called, God, what is the name of this thing? Ill Poets Society, the Aaron Ammons Project, right?
Okay.
On this project, there's a good friend of mine, his name is Yusef, who wrote about George Junius Stinney Jr.
Okay.
And who was executed at the age of 14 in Alkaloo, South Carolina. The youngest person to ever be executed in the United States. I'm going to play this piece, and then we're going to come back.
Okay.
Hopefully it's going to work. All right.
You're listening to Ill Poet Society.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. On March 23rd, 1944, in Alkaloo, South Carolina, these two white girls was riding bikes by the tracks that separate the whites and blacks. They was looking for maypop flowers, but within hours they came up missing. Wishing that I had never told the sheriff that I had seen them, the white girls' bodies turned up the next day in a ditch not too far from where I stay. I was even part of the search to find them, but I found myself being blamed for the murder of Betty June Binnaker and Mary Emma Thames, ages 11 and 8. I began to panic as the white folks' rage raced at a pace too swift for me to even contemplate getting someplace safe. And before I could even count to five, I heard somebody say the nigger boy was the last one to see him alive. I wanted to run, but my feet couldn't move. So I couldn't run, and there was no point at this point because I was quickly surrounded by a white mob with guns. I resigned myself to the fact that I was going to be lynched that very instant, but in that same instant, the sheriff grabbed me and took me to jail. My name is George Junior Stinney Jr., and I'm being arrested for the killing of Betty June Binnaker and Mary Emma Thames, ages 11 and 8. The mob followed us all the way to the jail. Meanwhile, I'm crying for my life and wanted to see my mother, because I wasn't guilty of nothing but being in the wrong place at the wrong time while being the wrong color. Small for my age, I was slightly built, but the interrogation proceedings began with a bunch of questions centered around the presumption of my guilt. You see, the good old boy reasoning wouldn't allow them to realize that at 5'1", 95 pounds, there was no way I could wrestle both girls to the ground, somehow manage to crush the skull of one while simultaneously subduing the other, and transporting both bodies away from the scene in broad daylight without being seen. But the resolve of the sheriff could not be understated, because he decided he was leaving that room with a confession even if he had to fabricate it. He offered me ice cream and said that I could go home and he'd forget it if I just admit that I did it. Now, after hours of questioning with fear, exhaustion, and the naivete of my age combining to compromise my judgment, I admitted being the perpetrator of the incident and in that very instant relinquished my innocence. The sheriff left the room and I heard him say he just confessed that he was after sex. The little nigger boy just put the noose around his own neck. Best bet we get him to Charleston and out of sight. The lynch mob won't let the nigger survive the night. My name is George Jr. Stinney Jr. and I'm being charged with the killing of Betty June Binnaker and Mary Emma Thames, ages 11 and 8. The next morning I was sitting in my cell and I heard an officer tell another that my father had lost his job and he and my family had left town the previous night in fear of their lives. I hadn't signed anything and no one talked to me about an attorney, but the jury selection began at 10, ended around 12 for the trial itself to start at 2:30. I couldn't do no bargaining and I wasn't in a position to, and that's probably how my defense attorney ended up being the county tax commissioner. Now, blacks were not allowed in the courtroom, so you know there were none on the jury. Quick, fast, and in a hurry with no witnesses, transcripts, written confession, or evidence. After 10 minutes, I was sentenced to death with no hesitance. My name is George Jr. Stinney Jr., and I have just been convicted of the double homicide of Betty June Binnaker and Mary Emma Thames, ages 11 and 8. By the time June 16th came, I resigned myself to the fact that I was going to die and convinced myself that I was not going to give them white folks the satisfaction of seeing me cry. Of this crime, I'm innocent. I done said it from the beginning, and my contention is not diminished one bit by your bigoted justice system or a death sentence from an all-white jury that deliberated my innocence for a whole of 10 minutes. I grabbed my Bible, and the guards walked me down the hall. A door at the end of the hall is all I saw. I walked in the room and handed the attendant my Bible and took a seat. But I was so small, the straps kept falling off and sliding down around my feet. The attendant looked at me and froze. I was too short to reach the face mask and electrodes. He took a second look and sat me on top of a stack of books. He stretched the electrodes to the limit to reach my head and cover my face with the mask is what he did. All of which was still too big. Then he pulled the switch. My body convulsed and twitched so much that my head came from under the bonnet, exposing my smoking nasal cavity and sizzling vomit. After 4 minutes, he turned off the power and my head lay tilted, with a sunken face, singed hair, and an eye missing. I'm sharing this with you so I'm not forgotten and the justice system is held accountable and in shame. Even though I may be long gone, don't give up trying to clear my name. My name is George Jr. Stinney Jr., and I was executed for the double homicide of Betty June Binnaker and Mary Emma Thames, ages 11 and 8. And to this day, at 14, the youngest ever to be executed in the United States.
All right.
Wow.
So this is how we also use art to tell the different narrative, or to tell the different narrative of this revisionist history that has written this 14-year-old out of history. And ironically, after Ray Morales pulled it together, Chris Evans did a lot of the artwork. The artist is Youssef, we call him Penn, who writes about this type of stuff. He dug this up. And soon thereafter, we found out that 70 years later, there was some sort of he was exonerated, I think, for the murders of these two young girls. But 70 years later, of course, after he's gone and went through this tragedy at 14 years old. But I found it, again, it's so relevant because as I went back, it just got adopted. It's going to be a part of the Harlem Film Festival. It's an underground or alternative type of almost kind of like a, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was just adopted as a part of a film festival because it's a short film type of thing on YouTube. And as I listened to it again, you know, even being a part of the project, this is my project, the Aaron Ammons project, but I didn't get everything about this until this situation in South Carolina came up again. So what I found as I listened to it, it was Alkaloo, what? South Carolina again.
Yep.
And here we get this violence is being perpetrated by the police. And then, of course, you have the young man that was killed by the police. Is it? Oh, God, I can't remember his name. So many names in my head now. The one who was running was shot in the back, right?
Unfortunately, there's so many to tell
And then you have what he said, let's get them to Charleston. And like you said in your work earlier, that Charleston was a different place where you may get the domestics and it's a little more tolerable, right? So the sheriff here is saying, hey, let's get him out of here and get him to Charleston because the lynch mob won't let him survive the night right down here in Alkaloo. But then I start to look even deeper at this. When did the shootings take place in the church? It was June 17th, I believe. He was executed June 16th.
Oh, right? My goodness.
You know, so there's this all this stuff that's going on in South Carolina. So I wanted you, Jane, to talk about how do you think what's going on in South Carolina right now? How much of it is an extension of what is always going on there? And
well, you know, that's what I was thinking the whole time you were talking and that I was listening to that powerful piece. It's not just South Carolina, sadly. That's where our focus is right now. But there are stories like this all through North Florida in the turpentine camps where Zora Neale Hurston did interviews and so on of people, you know, terrorism at Rosewood, Florida, all kinds of, I mean, every southern state probably you could make a long list of similar practices and some in the north as well that we just don't know as much about. And I think it's, you know, a tragedy that has to make something change, and it has to make us look at what's going wrong in the race relations and the training that can still allow people in some of these, you know, weird groups to continue to condone this kind of violence and these wrong attitudes and wrong history.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, thank you for joining me, man. It's always sure. good to see you. So, comments, if you want to ask the professor the question, Jane. She says Jane is fine for her. She
yeah, sure.
Okay, Jane. Yes, that was a powerful piece, by the way. It's like I was familiar with a 14-year-old young man being executed in the United States, but I didn't know his name. I didn't know the circumstances. Mm-hmm. God, what a weird coincidence. But, you know, I can't believe this stuff's happening again. I mean, you know, this stuff was, you know, I'm going to be 58 years old here in 3 weeks. So, I mean, this stuff, I grew up, you know, during the 60s and, you know, into the 70s. I mean, you know, for the longest time, this was something that only happened once in a while. And now all of a sudden it's starting to rear its ugly head again. And I wonder how much of all this police murder, and I'm going to call it that, police murder. To me, murder, if you kill an unarmed person, that's murder. I don't care what the circumstances are.
And in the back.
Yes, of how all these rash of police murders all over the country that obviously must be tolerated, at least, if not encouraged, by the people who control this country. I mean, how that spiked all of a sudden recently, and how what I'm getting to is how I'm wondering what you think about all these police murders maybe encouraging people like this that killed those people in the church and other groups and everything. And why aren't they? Why isn't he being prosecuted under domestic terrorism laws?
Hmm. Yeah, good question. You know, one of the things that I think this relates to also, we're talking about dehumanizing people, and
yes.
that's what lets you kill somebody and shoot them in the back. Dehumanization and fear maybe too, but I think back about how we developed this huge population of African-American men in the prison systems. And I remember when I was a social worker in the Liberty City Projects how that started to change because they began to privatize and make corporate business out of imprisoning people mm-hmm. forever mm-hmm. and how they began to make permanent sentences and three-strike rule and you're out, and they would just fill these prisons, which were contracted to individuals. And then there were the food contracts, then there were the clothing, then there was this and that, and it became a huge corporate business. And today we have this horrible incarceration problem, and you have simultaneously, as you were pointing out, more toleration, it looks like, for violence against these populations in the streets by people that are supposed to be upholding the law. So I think there's some kind of connection. It's not my field of study, but there are wonderful works now on the rise of the prison corporations. And in fact, President Obama has just started trying to, you know, evacuate some of those permanent sentences and give pardons to people that were sentenced for life for small things, drug crimes or mm-hmm. whatever. So I think the corporatization of imprisonment and the violence against people on the street are linked somehow. I wish somebody could examine that.
Wow, that's a good connection. I mean, I you know, it makes sense. Totally makes sense.
Yeah. So listen, Jane, we've got about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
I really appreciate the time and all that you've put
it's
into
been
it.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yes.
For having
Is
me.
There anything in particular that you'd like to share with people on just on the way out?
Oh, I just guess on the 4th of July to think about everybody helped make this nation. Everybody helped free this nation. The more educated we get about the complete history and not just the sort of standard 1619 ragged slaves getting off a boat, if you start the history there, that's how you're going to continue to see people. And if instead you think about free black explorers and military men who win honors for fighting in the American Revolution, I think you start from a whole different premise, and you couldn't keep up those fictions of inhumanity or subhumanity if you had a better history. So let's try to educate everybody.
Thank you, Jane, so much for everything, for calling in. I really appreciate
your
time.
Thank you for your interest, Aaron, and for your show and all the people that I've gotten to talk to on it. That was real interesting.
All right. Thank you very much. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. So, listen, folks, we are winding down very quickly. Paul is in the house, ready to come in and start some trouble as usual. Good kind of trouble, though. And we've got about 3 minutes left here. I got these. So July 29th, we have the Pathway to Apprenticeship workshop that's going to take place at Douglas Center. So, again, I want to remind people that's going to be from 1:30 to 4:30 at Douglas Center in the library meeting room. So the room, the big room connected to the library. You're welcome to come. This is in particular an opportunity to get African-Americans introduced, male and female, introduced to the let me send that right quick. Oh, yeah, there you go. Introduced to the trades. And I know that it's I want to make sure that I'm clear, folks. This is not a job fair. OK, so I don't want people to come thinking, OK, this they're here to hire you right on the spot. However, there is a looming $1.6 billion contract or something in Tuscola. Right. You know that, you know, we got different ambivalent feelings about, you know, but if things are continued, the construction is booming right now. So this is the time for individuals, especially those who have sought trades work or those who have and were turned away, to say, listen, this is the time for me to possibly get in as a tradesman and have a career as a tradesman. So we want you to come. We want you to bring your stories. I'm inviting all folks and inviting Dave Johnson for sure to come in, because we do need to challenge some things, quite a few things internally within the trades. I'm getting good response from people like Matt Langendorf and some other folks who are Rusty Davenport and Sam and Big Ed Rowden. There's a whole bunch of people that I've been in contact with that I never was in contact with before. So we're going to introduce folks to the trades. And I know that's part of your passion. So I hope that you would be there and help offer some perspective as
what
well.
What day of the week is that, Aaron?
So it's a Wednesday.
Okay.
It's a Wednesday. It's going to be from 1:30 to 4:30. And that's just the first one. We hope to do a series of these. And they were happening in Chicago as well. Of course, there's a lot of pressure being put on the trades through by the governor. But also this issue of lack of diversity has been an issue for the building trades in particular for a long time. So we're unearthing some of that and we're challenging some of that. And we I'm not going to stop until there's progress. Yes, indeed. So parting shots, what's going on with you today, Dave? What's happening on your hour, your
well,
labor hour?
We have a new co-host on the labor hour, a woman named African-American woman named Angela, and she's going to be, it's her birthday today, and we told her just to do, she's going to do a whole show. I mean, whatever she wants to do, we're just going to assist and maybe, you know, comment occasionally. So we don't know what it's going to be, so it's going to be a surprise for everybody.
Right.
We're kind of doing a summer, kind of a lax, not, I want to say lax, but kind of a more of an informal summer here on the labor hour.
Okay.
We pretty much are just going to leave ourselves open to whatever topic one of our co-hosts or maybe one of the listeners would like us to cover, and also be able to respond to events as they happen, because as you know, Aaron, there's a lot going on locally, statewide,
and nationally,
of course.
Yeah, Carol's Corner, we didn't get a chance to do that today, but call the governor's office. Let me. This was something I was supposed to say, Paul, if I can get this in real quick. Do call the governor's office. Trying to pull his phone number up. What is it? Doggone it. What did I do?
What do you want to say while you're
call the governor's office and tell him to sign and to agree to signing at least the temporary budget so that the essential services, so people who have daycare and Lincoln's Challenge and all these other different places that have been shut down because he refuses to sign at least a temporary budget.